All right. Finally, back in Building 26. Mark, how are you? Charles, who are you?
Good, thanks. Yeah. It's good to have you back and do another Channel 9 interview. The last one was a lot of fun. So I'm Mark Arsenovich. I'm a technical fellow in the Windows division. You're sitting right in the heart of things in Building 26.
Yes.
Where CoreOS division is basically centered.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working on long-term architectural stuff for Windows.
Cool.
I know everybody knows that Windows 7 is under development now.
But yes.
A lot of the things that I'm looking at are beyond Windows 7.
Beyond Windows 7.
Beyond Windows 7. Although part of my role on the Core Architecture Committee, which I told you about last time,
yes,
is to provide architectural guidance and mm-hmm. oversight for what's currently being developed. So there are Win 7 things that we meet and talk about.
So that's what a technical fellow does, huh?
Well, actually, there's about 20 technical fellows at Microsoft, and each one does different things. So
okay.
it's more of it's a technical title. It's not a positional or operational kind of title.
Okay.
So there's technical fellows that manage giant groups of people.
Interesting.
Like Terry Crowley is a technical fellow over in Office.
Okay.
And he's got a big org underneath him that he manages. And okay. Brad Levering also manages a whole bunch of people. And then you've got people that are individual contributors like me.
Cool. So let's get a little bit, before we dive into one of the purposes of this interview, what's it been like? I mean, you come from the outside world into the Death Star.
Yeah.
What's it like? How's your experience been?
It's just been fantastic.
Cool.
100%. No complaints at all.
Wow.
No, I'm just kidding. That'd be a nice job, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No, there's good days and bad days for... you know, the interesting thing is that Winternals, there's about 85 people at the time of the acquisition. And when a company like that that's your own is really small, you have a lot of direct influence over everything. There's
sure.
nothing that happens that you don't know about and can exert influence over. But as the company gets bigger and bigger, you start to become more of a salesperson. You've got to convince people their direction. You know, what you say carries a lot of weight because of who you are, but you still have to convince people that... You know, if they think you're taking the company in some stupid direction, they're not going to want to go there. They're not going to be effective, right? So,
sure.
Being in the position I'm in is a lot like that, actually, because I don't manage people. I can't tell them directly what to do. But for long-term strategic stuff, it's more of convincing people the right things. And
well, I would just interject this. I mean, I've never managed anyone else in my almost 9-10 years here at Microsoft. And I also get the sense that it's hard for managers to tell people what to do.
Yeah.
So my manager can't tell me what to do. Jeff knows much
better. He's got to convince you, right?
Yeah, he has to convince me.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I mean, if somebody's your manager, it doesn't mean they're smarter than you,
yeah.
right? Or know more than you, or, you know, they just basically want to be in the managerial track. But,
right.
But so you, of course, work with a bunch of architects and engineers in Windows who are some pretty bright people.
Right.
And so I would, with a lot of rich history, and you want to try to take Windows in a new direction, I would imagine. I mean, multiple people do. So you have to sort of wean yourself from the past.
Yeah.
So it must be very interesting. I'd love to hear some of those debates.
Well, that's part of it is, and that is one difference between managing, though, is that you control resources. You can, within what you manage, you can shift resources around to emphasize the things you think are important. Right? But as an individual contributor, I have to get other people to shift their resources to things that I think are important and convince them are important as well.
Sure.
But yeah, there's definitely debates. There's juggling the current, the near future and the long-term future, you know, and the business requirements of keeping Windows going.
Absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things, I mean, without getting into specifics, I remember when we talked to Core Arch probably 2 years ago now when Rob was still running it. And one of the comments that was made in there was that they think about the version beyond, the next version after the next version after the next version after the next version of Vista. So that's kind of interesting. And Vista is a snapshot in the evolutionary trajectory of Windows.
Yeah.
And so you guys spend time thinking about how it's going to evolve. Now, I would ask, do you use industry trends to help you with
Vision? Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll
give you one, and that's like Flash.
Uh-huh.
So we look really hard at Flash and what it means for Windows to have ubiquitous Flash on the motherboard, Flash on the hard disks, USB Flash keys floating around that are as big as, you know, in the near future they'll be as big as today's hard disks.
Wow.
So what does that mean for the OS and the way that we treat our storage hierarchy and memory? And then there's new memory technologies coming out. So there's power management trends.
Mm-hmm.
So a whole bunch of things that we look at to to figure out what should we be doing. It's really hard to look in the future and guess we're the right thing. Right?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the present. And we just released our RTN Windows Server, not RTN, RTN Windows Server 2008.
Actually,
right?
A release candidate.
Release candidate, sorry.
Yeah.
So release candidate, what, 2?
Something like that.
Something like that. It's one of the release candidates announced at TechEd, I believe. Sorry, we just RTN Visual Studio today, so I'm confused. But so let's talk a little bit about the internals, since you're a sysinternals person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dig a little bit, you know, give us an overview of what's new in the Windows Server 2008 kernel.
So, really timely question, because I happen to be in the middle of writing a TechNet magazine article on Server 2008 kernel changes, and speaking of TechEd, I just came back from TechEd IT Forum, where I gave a talk on Server 2008 kernel changes.
Excellent.
But there's changes across the board, and they range for everything from better support for NUMA hardware, and NUMA hardware is something that's a trend that is coming at us faster than I think most people realize. So while it sounds like NUMA, I'm talking about machines that are often the big data centers that a few people have. Actually, this Opteron box right here is a NUMA machine.
Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It means that memory is closer to one CPU than the other CPU, or one core, one socket versus another socket.
Interesting.
And so slight latency difference accessing close memory than further away memory, and the operating system is aware of that and optimizes for that.
So what does the operating system do?
So Server 2003 actually started to become NUMA aware, and one of the things that the scheduler did, for example, was try to keep a thread of execution on the node where its ideal processor is located. So one of the things that Windows scheduler does is it assigns each thread an ideal CPU, kind of its home base, and always tries to put it back there. The idea being that if a thread gets put back on its CPU that it was just running on, that there's stuff in the cache that's warm for it, and it doesn't have to rebuild that data. In a NUMA system, it makes sense to keep the thread close to the CPU, its ideal CPU, on the same node, because then there's hopefully data in the memory close to that that's localized to it as well.
Okay.
And the memory manager's undergone a lot of changes in Server 2008 to become more NUMA-friendly. So even if a thread gets migrated off its home base node to another node, when it performs memory allocations, those memory allocations will preferably come from the RAM of its ideal node, so that when it gets moved back there, it's close to the RAM that it allocated.
Interesting. And so Landy Wang has been busy.
Yeah, Landy's actually next door.
Excellent. Cool. So what else?
So what else? There's this scheduler's changed, and some of these changes actually are in the Vista kernel.
Okay.
And in fact, the Vista kernel is really a snapshot of what the server kernel has become, and in Vista SP1 and Server 2008 RTM are going to be very close to each other.
Interesting.
I don't know if they'll be the exact same kernel, but they'll be very close to each other, and so that means that all the things that are in the kernel, at least, or all those capabilities are in the both OSs. There's some layered functionalities that are only in one or the other, or some things that only make sense in one or the other. But so the NUMA stuff, for example, I'm running Vista right here. It's Landy's memory manager stuff is optimizing the performance from my NUMA box right here. Just a two-way Opteron. Most Opterons, multi-socket Opterons, are NUMA machines.
Okay.
But some of the other things, there's prioritized I/O, there's prioritized memory, there's cycle-based scheduling, so the scheduler keeps track of how many cycles threads use in its scheduling decisions. The big one, of course, is the hypervisor, Hyper-V, which is the new name announced for the virtualization technology. So it's our introduction of Windows hypervisor layer. That's a big feature of Server 2008. There's the transactional NTFS and transactional registry, which allows you roll back and commit ACID transaction semantics on those two resources and plugs in with higher-level transaction resource managers like SQL, so you can have transactions that span a bunch of different resources.
Nice.
There's cancelable I/O, which is it sounds like a little small feature, but it actually is a big one, cancelable create I/Os. And on client systems, this shows up as you net using some offline network share and being able to control C it mm-hmm. on Vista, whereas on XP and down level systems, you have to wait for the open to timeout because there's no way to cancel an open operation in the IO stack prior to Vista and Server 2008.
Nice.
Also in IO, there's scalability improvements in feature or component technology called IO completion ports, where because of the way IO completion port processing is handled on Server 2008, it minimizes the number of context switches on heavy network server workloads.
Okay.
There's way more.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, those are the big ones, and you can find out exactly every single detail by probably reading a white paper or something. But one of the things that in my personal opinion, that really intrigues me about Windows Server 2008 is the notion of server core, mm-hmm. which is basically a shell-less server. And when you think about the way Windows is architected, that was a kind of a hard problem to solve given the interdependencies between what happens up in shell world and what goes on down in the kernel and the shared resources that could live in the kernel that the mm-hmm. shell relies on. So what did you do to be able to create a server core? I mean, first of all, I had to understand all the dependencies and then pull them out?
That's a really interesting question, and it's also timely because that's a big focus of what we like to do is layer and componentize the system. And I think when you had the Channel 9 interview with the core architecture team a few years ago, Rich Neves was there talking about layering and mapping the layers and dependencies between different pieces of Windows. And that work is exactly what the engineering layering and dependency work that we've got going on is based on. Mm-hmm. As far as server core, that kind of being able to draw a line around a chunk of Windows that's not the whole thing. Now, it is a big thing. Server core is like 1.2 gigabytes in size. So it's a pretty big chunk, but yet it cuts off a lot of stuff that you just don't want in this on your server.
Okay.
And the way that we figured out where to draw those lines to cut off is, again, using the dependency layering maps, identify the pieces that are connected to that core, that chunk, break the dependencies where we can, and otherwise just slice it off and analyze the loads that are going to be run on server core to make sure that there's no dependency on that dependency.
Okay.
So that you're not running, you don't do some operation, can't do some operation in server core that ends up calling up to this other piece that's not there. Mm. So it's not engineered isolation of that component. It's more like analyzed and best effort, right? There's pieces, there are links off to other pieces that aren't there. They're just never exercised with what server core delivers. And the reason I say it's relevant is because Eric Trout gave a talk at the University of Illinois where he mentioned something called MinWin. And, and there's a lot of confusion out there about what MinWin is and how it relates to server core.
Yeah, I thought they were related.
And a lot of people do. And actually, it's kind of unfortunate that the name MinWin was used at one point early in the development of server core. And internally and in some public presentations like at WinHack. So a lot of people, when they heard MinWin again, thought, oh, that's the MinWin that was the basis for Server Foundation or Server Core. And actually, the MinWin that we're talking about today is something pretty different. And the MinWin that we're talking about today is really what Rich Neves and Rich Pletcher have done with the help of a bunch of other people to analyze the dependencies and carve out the lowest, smallest core component of Windows that would be a standalone testable slice of Windows. And that is really analyzing the dependencies and cutting the lines, the cycles from MinWin to higher level components, making sure that MinWin doesn't depend on anything else, that it's totally self-contained.
Excellent.
So it can be built separately from the rest of the Windows source tree. And can it run independently the Windows source tree as Eric showed in his VM demo.
So let me ask you this. Let me stop you right there and ask this one quick. Now, my understanding, so what you're saying is that the kernel can't run independent of the shell? I mean, what does the kernel depend on that's running in the shell today? I mean, couldn't I take
so
a Windows kernel?
So when we say the kernel, the word kernel is used loosely to mean a whole bunch of different things. And when I say kernel, MinWin... being a kernel, that means what I'm saying is that the kernel is NTOS kernel. It's the stuff, the core of Windows that runs in kernel mode. Huh. It's got a lot of support components around it that also run in kernel mode. And then there's layers of system-level components that run in user mode but are still part of the core OS.
Okay.
And so depending, some people call kernel that whole core OS, you know, some people call kernel just the part that's in NTOS kernel, and then some people even call kernel even a small component inside of NTOS kernel.
Okay.
They consider that the kernel. In fact, internally in the source tree, there's a small piece called the kernel inside of NTOS kernel. So there's a lot of confusion about the word kernel.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.
So when I'm, if I use the word kernel around MinWin, I'm really talking about core of the system, and that includes some system-level stuff that doesn't... In fact, there's no window manager inside of, or windowing subsystem inside of MinWin. Mm. So all the dependencies on that stuff are cut off. And so it doesn't depend on having user GDI, win32k.sys, the Win32 the subsystem driver in it. And you ask about how can we make, you know, why would that stuff depend on the shell? Well, you bring in some stuff on top of that, and then that ends up bringing this piece, which ends up bringing this piece, which ends up bringing, you know, shell WAPI 32.dll and Shadok views, two of the core shell DLLs, and you basically got the shell then, and that brings in a whole bunch of other things. And I mean, it really is a, you pull in one thing, and you pulled in the whole world, really, from a dependency point of view.
Interesting.
So that's really what core server core really is. You pull in one thing and you've really pulled in the whole thing. What they've just done is snip lines, you know, snip those lines with the scissor, basically, where you still bring it in, but because nothing you're doing will ever exercise those lines out, it's okay.
Excellent. Well, that's really cool. So, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about componentization is the ability to enable rapid innovation in various parts of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly that's a big thing on your mind right now, as you mentioned, as Windows evolves. You know, but anyway, we won't diverge too much, but I'm really interested in the idea of the evolution of Windows, because I've seen it go through various iterations. So let's talk a little bit more about some certain things. One of the things that was mentioned in that interview was FastRPC. Whatever happened to that?
FastRPC?
Yeah, like I said, that's what one of the I can't remember the guy's name. The very gregarious guy in that interview. I don't know. He's been in Microsoft forever.
This is the one with Eric Cutts presentation?
No, this was actually before that. This was actually,
I know. There was the Channel 9 interview with Corey.
Anyway, there's a random one for you. Maybe
FastRPC. Well, I don't. There's something called Advanced LPC, which is in Vista in Server 2008, which is better performing.
That's probably
local
what I mean.
Procedure call.
Okay, yeah.
Functionality.
All right.
So that might be what you're talking about, and that is in the kernel. But I don't know without going back and looking at that.
Sure, that's fine. So let's get you on the whiteboard and draw out. Let's draw.
Yeah.
The kernel and its components and your definition of kernel.
All right.
I certainly take you as being authoritative on that definition over myself. And it's always fun to get technical fellows and architects up on the whiteboard. So, yeah, let's draw it out and see what we got going on here for 2008.
So, you've got NTOS kernel here and abbreviated with NTOS right there.
Okay.
Running in kernel mode, so we've got the user mode, kernel mode boundary here.
Yep.
And that's just kernel. You can spell kernel. Other pieces that you've got in kernel are other, basically the drivers, so device drivers. You've got win32k.sys down here, which is another big piece of the system. And this has a user and GDI components. User being the window management stuff, and GDI being the window graphics related functionality. So this is bitmaps and drawing lines and bit blitting.
Okay.
This be sending messages and creating windows. Then you've got the hardware abstraction layer under here, the HAL, and then the hardware down here. And the hardware abstraction layer basically manages the parts of the system, motherboard, and CPU, the I/O controller,
okay,
that basically it acts like a device driver for the motherboard.
Cool. And where does the hypervisor live?
So the hypervisor, this is running at ring zero and ring ring three of the x86 architecture. The hypervisor is running at a layer down here.
Nice.
So this just abbreviated hypervisor with the big H, little V, and then on top of the hardware right here.
Okay.
And this new layer we call negative one, which is, we call it negative one because it sits underneath ring zero, has full control of the hardware and can gate control even for something running in what's traditional ring zero.
Hmm.
And this is made possible with the virtualization assists that are in modern AMD and Intel processors.
Excellent. Cool.
And in the, might as well take this and tell you about the, our hypervisor architecture, which
absolutely
is a little bit different than
absolutely
other people's, if you want to see that.
Yes.
And basically, very simply, we've got the hypervisor here running as basically a substrate on top of the actual hardware. And we've got something that we've got here, the root partition, which is running this is rings, and this would be the virtual machine management stack up in user mode, and then the kernel and TOS and the HAL here, and then device drivers like I showed before, and Win32. You can tell I don't write much anymore.
No,
everything's typing.
Yeah, I bet. Thinking and emails and papers.
And this root partition, this would be typically would be server core.
Ah, okay.
Running the virtualization role. And this root partition basically has control of the machine. And that allows the device drivers to talk directly through to the hardware from this partition of the machine. And then you've got other partitions, and you come across various names for these other partitions. I'll call them child partitions here, because they're really, or they're also guest partitions, child one and child two. And then these are running their own ring three and ring zeros with their own operating systems. So if they're running Windows, they'd be in TOS and up here apps in each of these.
Hmm.
And they don't have direct access to the hardware, because that would be a violation of the security guarantees that we're making around these child partitions.
Sure.
The child partition can't take over the root partition, can't see into other child partitions, can't control other child partitions. And so the way that they interact with hardware, they've got virtual device drivers, and they talk through a virtual bus, which is really something built on top of the hypervisor to allow communication between the guests and the roots, so that the virtual device drivers can make requests of the real device drivers through this virtual bus, and then that gets into virtualization software inside the root, which then would redirect those IOs down to the real hardware. So the other architecture, the virtual hypervisor architecture of other companies, which will remain nameless, are slightly different than this, in that their hypervisor runs on a full-blown OS with device drivers down here. And what that requires from them is specialized device drivers for this specialized operating system that they've got here. That also offers them the ability to go directly from their child partitions directly to hardware devices, just by going right into the hypervisor layer, whereas we've got this virtual bus communication where you go basically down and back up and down.
Sure.
So what we've done is spent a lot of time optimizing the performance of that path to make sure it's really efficient. And even though there is a performance hit that you take for that extra path length, we feel that it's more than justified for a couple of reasons. One is that our hypervisor is very small and very thin, which this, really you want this and the virtual bus communication interface to be rock solid. And the surface area that we've got here is minimized by us having this thin hypervisor with this virtual bus to ensure, to allow us to be really confident that really the boundary that we put around your child partitions is really rock solid, so that you get a malicious, some malicious app here uh-huh. inside your child partition, and it's not going to be able to poke a hole into the hypervisor or into the root partition.
Excellent.
And allow it to compromise your whole server box. The other big advantage that we get is that these device drivers that you've got here to talk to the devices, the hardware devices, mm-hmm. are your native Windows device drivers. So we don't have any kind of special version of Windows that you got to have special certified device drivers to run virtualized. These are just out-of-the-box device drivers you're going to be able to run on this thing. Okay. So that's another advantage. And then finally, to manage the whole machine, this root partition is just, like I said, it's typically server core, although you could be running full server on top of there. And so you manage this thing with the system management tools that you're deployed throughout your data center. Basically, this is just another server box. And from the point of view of managing this software, it's just another machine.
Cool. And so I guess, you know, being sort of a client OS person myself, based on what I know, I mean, where does this pattern fit into the client? So, I mean, virtualization, can't get, obviously, into details at all, but certainly I see an interesting possibility architecturally.
So, I guess the question you're aiming at is, is there a hypervisor on the client?
Yeah.
Or will there be?
Is there plans? I mean, and why wouldn't there be?
We've definitely been looking hard at that, mm-hmm. so I can't say one way or another what we're going to do
at
this point, but... Yeah. The question that you got to ask yourself is what scenarios really are enabled through virtualization?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That makes sense. And on a server, obviously, machine consolidation is a big one. Uh-huh. There's other uses for virtualization on a server, like the virtual desktop infrastructure for enterprises to be able to have users connect right to a virtual machine mm-hmm. from their desktop, a la terminal server type connections. On a client system, the kinds of scenarios that we've already seen people use virtualization for are basically test mm-hmm. and demonstration, so that you can have VMs that go around walking around with your client and fire up a Server 2008 VM on your mm-hmm. Vista machine and test something or demonstrate something from it. Some of the other things that people get excited about when they think about client virtualization are, wouldn't it be nice if I had, and so you got the hypervisor here, and then you've got a bunch of partitions, and one of these is considered your true Windows partition, and then the question is, what do you use for this other partition? And there's lots of companies out there that have been looking at and talking about and promoting, let's say that this is the management partition, or this is the AV partition, or this is the telephony partition. So this is where you would do your IP communications. And the question is, what software are you running in here? Mm-hmm. How much complexity does that add to your management of the whole box? Mm-hmm. How much does that detract in terms of performance? Because just having a hypervisor here is going to cost you some performance, and having this here all the time is going to cause you performance because this thing's going to have a memory footprint.
Okay.
Like I said, the management aspects of just this, like how do I update, how do I service this thing, how do I make sure that it's secure mm-hmm. is another question. And then what am I delivering here that's not best delivered inside of here? Like why do I really want to move the IP stack into, or the IP telephony stack, communication stack into this separate partition where I couldn't achieve the same thing with the mechanisms that are already in Windows.
Sure.
Or if I couldn't achieve the exact same things, are the costs of the management and the security and the servicing and so on, and the resource requirements of this, having this over here, are they really outweighed by the benefit I get out of moving that out of Windows itself? So those are the kinds of things we've been taking a really hard look at.
Interesting. One of the sort of science fiction-y kind of ideas that, you know, I've had, and might be just bullshit, which is fair enough, but would be to have certain components of Windows running in their own virtual machine. such that when Raymond Chen asks to add something new to the shell, you just download it and it runs. So, of course, that's so much easier said than done because of all the complexities, but that's one of the things I was thinking that would be interesting use of virtualization. And
so I think that kind of virtualization you're talking about, this is machine virtualization.
Okay.
And then the virtualization you kind of alluded to there is application virtualization. So a lot of people watching this are probably familiar with SoftGrid and Softricity, which is a company that was Microsoft acquired a little over a year ago.
Cool.
And SoftGrid is part of the Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack, and that is application virtualization. So that kind of virtualization is
outside of the scope of the hypervisor.
It's outside the scope of the hypervisor, right? That is, you've got the Windows kernel, so kernel mode. And then you've got user mode here. And then this app, Office is one of the big commonly virtualized apps with SoftGrid, is now running in a bubble so that when Office makes changes to the registry, those changes go to virtual registry, just call it VR, whereas Office, another instance of Office might be running here not inside of SoftGrid, and when it makes changes to the registry, it goes to the real registry. And this virtual registry is stored off in some well-known place for SoftGrid's point of view, so you can basically take this and lift it off the machine and put it on another machine, and now Office, what its view of the registry is this, basically, and on top of this, but all of the important stuff for Office is here, so all your settings are in there, Office's installation configurations all in that virtual registry, and also virtual file system.
Cool.
And all the changes that you make when you're interacting with this are isolated into this blob right here. So this virtualization has a lot of benefits that people got really excited about, like the fact that it's zero touch on the client. Like you said, Raymond Chen writes his shell extension. Well, really, Raymond Chen writes his Office app.
Yeah.
And has no impact on the machine itself. So you can just delete this blob, and it's as if Office was never there.
Nice. That's very interesting.
Yeah. So what the reason, though, that what SoftGrid does with this virtual registry and virtual file system is it's aimed at legacy applications that aren't written to be virtualized. So they or not separate their state very well. So they mingle their state, their user state, with their application state. They also mingle their own state with the state of the machine. So Office might make changes to the state of the machine, like installing things in the program files directory and making changes to the HKEY classes root, the COM registration database. If we had a model where applications can make those kinds of configuration changes and do them in such a way that it's architected not to have an impact on the machine, or at least where we know exactly where those changes are, then we wouldn't need this virtual file system and virtual registry. So the virtual file system and virtual registry are basically there for legacy apps to be able to contain them, make them think that they're running, you know, on the bare OS, on bare Windows.
Sure.
But really, we're watching what they do and capture those changes so that they can be we can watch the changes, know exactly where that changes are, and then rip them off.
Cool.
And only it sees them.
That's a really interesting technology. So what else should we talk about here regarding Windows that we can discuss? I mean, you touched a little bit on MinWin. MinWin is not server core, the other way around. So everybody get that out there? Okay. I understand that now.
Good.
All right. And your definition of kernel is more than just ntkernel.dll. Right?
Well, I don't know if I've got, even if I have my own definition, other people use the word, and I've got to adapt to how other people use the word
of
kernel.
Of course.
So, but when I talk about kernel, really what I typically mean is NTOS.
Okay.
And closely associated system service layer, which is up here in user mode, ntdll.
Cool.
ntdll.dll.
Cool.
In any case, I gave a change call, the talk that I gave at IT Tech at IT Forum, Windows Vista kernel changes.
Yeah.
But in the context of a talk like that, mm-hmm. I'm addressing the definition of kernel that most people have, which is it's all the stuff below the app, right, that comes in, what is Windows, and that's the kernel. And not maybe not necessarily the shell, but all of the other stuff, the system layer level stuff. So things like NTFS, they'd consider part of the kernel, whereas technically I don't consider that part of kernel, but I'll call it kernel-level changes for the purposes of making people understand what I'm going to talk about.
Excellent. So just one last question that I have would be, since they share the same code tree or the same kernel, not exactly the same, obviously, but my question would be, what are some of the enhancements that are required for a server versus the client? Right? They both need to be secure, but one of them is getting pounded with constant usage.
Right.
Right. So what are some of the specific things that you've done, say, in the kernel world, if it happens to be in the kernel for VS, for Windows Server 2000?
Yeah. So from the kernel point of view, like focusing on NUMA, that's much more, even though my client system is a NUMA machine, it's not nearly as NUMA as a 64-way NUMA box.
Absolutely.
Where memory is, the latencies between memories of different nodes is significant, and you've got to to maximize performance on that machine, you really need to have the kernel, both the scheduler and the memory manager, understand the topology of the machine so it can move things around and keep things co-located intelligently. Hmm. So that is, like, the NUMA work is mostly focused on the server side of things. The there's the security stuff you mentioned, and security's important for client and server.
Sure.
So the ASLR, the address space load randomization, and the data execution prevention stuff applies to both. The service security hardening stuff, which is some stuff that was introduced in Vista and has evolved a little bit further in Server 2008, where especially on servers, you've got services that are sitting out on the network and somebody figures out a way to exploit them and get code running in them. You want, even despite ASLR and DEP, you want to constrain that infestation to just that process and just the resources that that service would require access to.
Excellent.
So we've got this principle of least privilege around the services. Really, I see that as more server focused than client focused, but it applies to both. And that's a step in the evolution further down that path that we've made in Server 2008. Some of the changes actually apply to client and server, and work. You need both sides to really work well. So one of the big investments is in a brand new network file system protocol, SMB2, which was introduced in on the client side in Vista and on the server side in Server 2008. And so with SMB2, it overcomes a lot of the limitations of the original SMB protocol, which is also called the Common Internet File System Protocol, CIFS. The limitations of that protocol, which were developed 15 years ago, are that it assumes certain data transfer characteristics that don't make sense anymore, like small buffers. The largest buffer SMB can transmit is about 60K of data in one I.O. And now we're transmitting huge amounts of data across our file systems, our in client-server scenarios. Speaking of virtualization, you copy a VHD from a client to server, vice versa, and that's just gigabytes of data. So SMB2 gets rid of that limitation of packet size on a communication request. We've also it's more focused on WAN environments where there's a latency between the client and server, so now there's batching of operations back and forth to minimize the number of round trips. So if you've got, the only way to get the enhancements or improvements out of that is to have both your client and your server talking SMB2. Right. If one or the other doesn't understand SMB2, you're not going to get it. So that's where one of those better together slogans actually works for.
And the transactional NTFS is only in server?
That's in both client and server, actually.
Good.
So that was introduced in Vista. And the transactional NTFS and transactional registry, one of the places that's used both in the client and server is by Windows Update. So when you're installing a hotfix, the hotfix installation is protected with transaction.
Nice.
And what that means is hotfix will typically update some files and make some registry changes. Prior to Windows having transactions, all of those operations are done in kind of a best effort to make sure that if the system went down, mm-hmm. like the power was pulled or there was a crash, or mm-hmm. that you'd get back into a bootable state. But it's impossible to really do that and mm-hmm. service these pieces mm-hmm. without in a way that you can guarantee across that whole update that that's going to happen.
Excellent.
So what transactions do is make it so that you make those changes, they actually go into a log, and it's only when the transaction is committed that those changes get actually, in one single shot from the point of view of anybody looking from the outside, appear on the file, in the file system registry. So you crash before the transaction is committed, it's as if you didn't even install the hotfix.
That's
you crash after, and obviously your hotfix is there. So.
Okay. Well, that's really cool. Excellent. So this was good to come and talk to you again. I'm sure you have work to do. We will come and visit you again and talk about Windows 7 when we're allowed.
All right. Sounds good.
And I can understand why we can't, because you guys are still figuring it out.
Yeah, still baking.
Very cool. Well, great to talk to you again.
All right. Great talking to you, Troy.
See ya.